Welcome to Roguecast, the official podcast of Rogues Gallery. We'll talk comics for the week, as well as whatever news is on our pop cultural radar. I'm Randy.
I'm Nick.
This is Dave.
And now, on with the show.
Episode 393 of the Roguecast, recorded November 8th, 2022. Jar Jar is a friend of mine.
All right. As we speak, I'm on the verge of going to BGGCon.
Yes. Which, by the time you hear this, Randy yes. will be departed from this world.
Wait, what?
Randy will have left for BGGCon.
Oh, so next week there'll be a huge update on board games and all that kind
yep.
of thing for sure.
We're gonna make you spill on everything you know. All right. We're gonna put the hot light on you.
Okay,
it's gonna be like in Dick Tracy, which is a movie that was in the 90s. For
yes,
people who
don't
know.
Yes, I was gonna say that movie is I think 30 years old.
Yeah,
Randy has to be Mumbles.
We're gonna make you talk like they made Mumbles talk. Anybody who hasn't seen Dick Tracy, go watch it just to see that scene with Dustin Hoffman. It's fun.
And then we're going
to
record you, and then we're going to slow down what you say, and then understand you. Yeah, so it's going to be a whole bit.
And I'll be in a... Someone is going to be in a Dayglo yellow trench coat.
That's just my normal Dayglo yellow trench coat.
I'm going to be like... is it William Forsythe who played Flat Top?
Yep.
Yeah, I will be Flat Top.
Also, Madonna will be here.
What's she doing? She's not doing really.
She's always reinventing herself.
Yes.
Now she's reinventing herself as a comics clerk. It's a little sexy yes. comics clerk.
And then Mandy Patinkin will be here to do our intro and outro.
Yes.
Madonna is sexy octogenarian comic clerk.
That's
hard to say oxygenarian.
Yeah.
And I don't know what that is.
Is that her new movie coming out?
Yes.
Anyway... we talked about this last week, just a reminder, Black Friday sale's coming up in a couple weeks.
Yep.
We're going to do, first $25 you spend, you get a blind bag of dice, one of our cool little blind bags.
Yes.
A mini plastic set.
Yep.
And then every $50 you spend, you get one of our cool owlbear coins, which is good for $10 of merchandise.
Yes.
Also, we have not set them out just yet, but we're doing something else new this year, starting probably next week, the White Elephant pre-wrapped gifts.
Oh, yeah.
So we're going to try this out. This is an idea we stole from another store online. Basically, we packed up a bunch of board games, anywhere from 30 to 40 MSRP. We pre-wrap them, so they're basically a blind box. You can buy a board game for $20 that is worth more than that, and just take it to whatever White Elephant party, office exchanges, friend you don't know that well.
You want to get for yourself.
Give them a board game. Yeah.
Yeah.
If you want to give yourself a present, you can put it under the tree.
You do whatever you want.
You do whatever you want.
Don't hold us to whatever weird standard
you have. You can put Santa's name on it and pretend Santa gave you a present.
Yep.
We're
not going to rat you out.
No, we will not.
Nick might rat you out. I don't know. I won't.
Sorry. The elf on the shelf is going to tell him.
By the way, I
never trust elf on the shelf. That's no. they're mean.
Speaking of just other stuff... We did have some more comic grab bags out as well.
Oh yeah,
There we had made a bunch of the mature readers ones, but now there are what, Marvel and DC?
A handful of Marvel and DC, which will probably be gone pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But you want the good stuff. You want the boobies.
Man, the mature readers ones are good. It's got Image books in there. There's Boom books in there.
Yep.
And people don't know how good the
much full frontal. Let's get to the chase.
That depends on what you're willing to.
There's
tip
not
Dave.
Full. There's not full frontal. There's full Monty.
By the way, Dave, I like the transition. Speaking of stuff,
I was trying to think of thinking of promotions of gifts we give away. I didn't, and then the words fled.
I understand.
This is the excitement of live radio.
Well, speaking of stuff, we did get some new stuff in this week.
Oh, go on, tell me more about this stuff.
Speaking of stuff, it's a yogurt-like substance
that eats
your brain and turns you into a zombie. That's a reference to a 1980s movie, I believe.
That scared the living daylights out of me as a kid.
The Living Daylights is a different movie. That came in the 90s.
I know, I was making a pun.
Actually, Living Daylights was the 80s.
Oh, was it really?
It was 87.
Oh, God, we're all old.
Just because I remembered it doesn't mean I'm old.
But not as old as Madonna, our new sexy comic clerk.
I still got it, boys.
Anyway, we're off the rails.
Like
already.
A virgin.
Is that the Bollywood version?
I was thinking it was like, who's the Ethel Merman?
Ethel
Merman
yes.
style.
Okay. Who I only knew from the parody of her in Airplane, a 1970s movie.
Let's move on. Let's carry on.
Anyway, speaking of stuff.
Yes.
We got, I think we may be out of it again, but hopefully we'll be back in Flamecraft, the new game. Where you have delightful dragons and you craft things.
That was supremely popular.
Yeah, it's a super popular
game. I think we posted on online and it was gone.
Yeah. I need to check and see if it's actually still available or if we're getting it back in. But we had it, which is good for you if you wanted it, but not if you want it now. But we might have it again.
By the time you hear this, we might have it. Who knows?
Who knows?
Just come in and check. You might find other things.
What we do have is the Mighty Tarrasque.
Oh, that's true.
Oh, yeah.
We have this is the biggest, one of the bigger minis that D&D has done. The bigger maybe than Tiamat, I'm not sure.
No, it's not as big as Tiamat.
And one of the mightiest monsters in all of D&D. I was trying to pin it down because I don't know a lot about the Tarrasque, but it's basically like the rampaging Godzilla of D&D.
Yeah, the thing is, like, it's built up over time. Like, when it was first introduced in, like, Monster Manual 2 or something like that, I think it was Monster Manual 2, it is this big monster that is unique. There's only supposed to be one of them.
Yep.
Of course, in the multiverse now, there's probably multiple Tarrasques. So you never.
So, like, in all of the D&D world, there's
supposed
one of
to be
them?
One Tarrasque. I don't think that is still true, but that originally it was unique. It was the one Tarrasque.
So now there are baby Tarrasques?
And maybe baby Tarrasques.
Oh.
it has, like, a massive armor class, tons of hit points, armors, you know, damage reduction of every kind.
My memory,
spell resistance, it's
from back in the day, and I don't know if this is still true, was that it was, like, so awful that you had to use, like, a wish spell to permanently kill it.
Yes.
Like, you had to, like, not only defeat it, but then you had to use the wish spell and stuff like that.
If I'm correct, I believe it sort of naturally reflected spells. Like, if you cast a fireball, it would bounce back at you.
So how do you fight it?
You have to be, like, super high level and have all kinds of magic items. It is basically, okay. It is kind
and
of...
And it's going to be a long fight.
The Tarrasque... I think Tarrasque is a halfling word that translates to "fuck you." I'm the DM.
Although it'd be kind of cool for in a scenario where a Tarrasque is demolishing a city and you're trying to save a bunch of people and like getting them out of them.
Yeah,
yeah,
that would be
actually
fun.
Building up a story around first, like sort of saving the city and then sort of driving it off, or if you
or just
you
letting the
it.
City burn. I mean,
or since we have three of them, you could buy all three. And all your high-level PCs could ride Tarrasques into battle.
Tarrasque fight!
Anyway, it's a really cool-looking mini. It is one of these legendary D&D monsters. Yeah. It is one of these, once it's gone, it's going to be gone.
Yep.
So if you have any interest, also seems like maybe if you have a D&D person in your life, the perfect Christmas gift, they will love you forever. Mm-hmm. You'll get the Nintendo Kid effect when they open it up.
Without the Tarrasque, you're nowhere.
We got the Smash Up 10th Anniversary Edition. Smash Up, popular game, been around for apparently 10 years.
Okay.
It is
Smash Up.
Not unlike Marvel Snap that we were all enjoying. And I think Nick and I are still playing. Dave has abandoned it.
Yes.
I'm waiting.
That
but
was
I'm
enough
good.
Of that.
I'm still playing. I was very annoyed that they dropped me down to level 10 again.
That is, that I don't like that. Yeah, the new season
10.
Passes. When the new season started.
When a new season starts, your fighting goes back down to, like, the level 10.
Yeah. But okay. It means I get a chance to be gold again, Nick, and feel accomplished.
But you're still fighting people who are just as good, if not better than you, so it becomes exponentially harder.
I don't know. I guess I'm just good at it.
Guess you are. Guess
you're
opponent
noobs.
You must
be the master.
I'm so good at Marvel Snap. You guys, I'm so good at it. It's like, it's like I'm going
to
put it on a record.
Definitely when people come in, be sure to ask Rainey about his mad Marvel Snap
yes,
skills.
Definitely.
I'm
going to
make
sure.
You a sign.
It's going to help me a lot in life.
Just hangs around his it's a little piece of twine keeps around his neck and just
it's
says I heart Marvel Snap
scrawled on there. I am so good at Marvel Snap.
I are best.
At least three of the words are missing.
What is Marvel Snarp?
Anyway, Smash Up has something in common with it that there's bases you're trying to activate.
Yeah, okay.
And you but the cool thing about Smash Up is it's you get two different factions like ninjas, then dinosaurs, and then you have a deck that is these mashed up versions of them.
Yeah, bunch of crazy stuff from pop culture. Zombies, robots, stuff like that.
Anyway, this is the 10th anniversary. It's got a couple factions that have been out of print or convention exclusives and is a new base set. Also, another thing we got, the Super Skill Pinball Christmas Edition. This is a roll and write that simulates pinball. I've played it. I really like it. The Christmas one has a...
It's like a combination of, like, movies and stuff,
so it's
right?
So basically they have those different boards. So it's like you're playing pinball. So it's like these are pinball machines. And the ones they have are Christmas Story,
Christmas Vacation
and Elf,
I
think.
Yeah, an Elf, yeah.
Which is
that's
pretty
wild.
Cool. So another good Christmas game thing.
I would have totally played a Christmas Vacation pinball machine, though.
Yeah, yeah. There may be one.
Probably they are.
We got the newest D&D minis, the Gang of Skeletons.
Oh yeah, yeah.
We've gotten the Grung and
cool.
The Orgers, and that was cool.
Yeah, you just get a pack of a box. Nicely, these are pre-painted.
Yep, pre-painted.
Yeah, nicely pre-painted skeletons.
Like, I think 8 or 10.
So you don't have to go and paint a bunch of stuff in off-white, and then go in with the shading and stuff like that, and add washes.
All done.
They did it. Some guy did it.
Some guy named Gabbo.
his Terrence.
From Kickstarter, we've got Absolute Power. Did we mention that already? I feel like I was
We gonna... did.
Okay, yeah. And also Final Girl 2. We had talked about this before, but we now got everything. They screwed up our shipping, but we have the not only the big deluxe package. This is not Final Girl 2. It is Final Girl back in print.
Okay.
The Final Girl 2 is still coming out. But this has, like, bonus scenario packs and miniatures and a lore book and all kinds of, like, bonus stuff. So if you have a fan of like, solo games and horror games in your life, this will you could get, like, the all-in-one Kickstarter thing. And they'll be like, how'd you get all this? You'll be like, it's my secret. I'm Santa.
My brother has been playing this and enjoying it. Oh, nice. He was filling me in on a little bit about it the other day. Clearly enthusiastic your to brother, the point where I was like, okay, that's enough.
Your brother is the final girl.
He is.
All right. Moving on to news, mostly casting news. Aubrey Plaza has joined Agatha Coven of Chaos, which is the spinoff from WandaVision.
Might remember Aubrey Plaza from such shows as
Legion, Parks and Rec,
and such movies as.
She's got a couple of movies. What's that one where she's like the crazy girl who goes across country?
Ingrid Goes West.
That's it.
Okay.
She also was in a new one called something Criminal. I forget. It's supposed to be really good.
I really like Aubrey Plaza. She's always good. She was great in Legion.
She's in this season of White Lotus. I'm hoping that she is
playing
awesome.
A young version of Agatha.
Oh, that would make sense.
In like flashbacks or something.
That would make sense. I could sort of see that.
Because I feel like she'd kind of fit it. Yeah. She usually plays people who are a little off kilter.
But she may be like a rival witch.
Sure.
That'd be fun, too.
She's a talented actress. I think she'll be good for any of the
Are there any other magic users in the Marvel Universe?
Nope, that's it. No, that's it.
Yeah, Agatha. We've seen those. We've got Agatha. We've got Wanda. Scarlet Witch.
That's it.
Doctor Strange.
Clea. Those are all done.
Yeah.
We even saw Rintra, the Green Minotaur. They're all done. Donnie Blaze.
Jeez.
I hope Donnie Blaze reoccurs. I hope Madison
I will
reoccurs.
Say, I mean, other than, like, the Enchantress, I can't think of a whole lot of... I can't think of a lot of other spellcasters.
Enchantress.
Dr. Druid. But Enchantress needs to come in a Thor thing.
Yes, she does.
Although, actually, you know what? Now that Thor stuff, now that there is, like, new Ragnarok.
Yeah, Asgard.
New Asgard. you know, and stuff like that. And, like, you know, She-Hulk is trying cases that have elves and stuff in them.
There was an elf.
You could have the Enchantress outside of Thor lore, I think, and it would work.
She could show up in Coven of Chaos. Maybe that's her Aubrey Plaza point.
Maybe so, although their like hair color is wrong.
I don't like that. She's got to be a blonde.
I was just looking up other magic users of the Marvel Universe. I could see her as Satana.
I can kind of see that, actually.
Satana's a little bit more on the crafty side and less loopy. I feel like she's a little more loopy.
No, Aubrey can crafty.
Okay.
Her Legion, she plays a Shadow King in Legion.
Also, I don't want to say it, but she could also be Morgan Le Fay.
God, I don't want Morgan Le Fay anymore. she could also be Brother Voodoo.
Morgan Le Fay, by the way, needs to be English.
Yes, that's
like,
true.
You have to have an English accent.
You know what would be better than her being English? Her not being in the Marvel Universe.
People don't know about their prejudice against Morgan Le Fay. That is to say, the Marvel incarnation of Morgan Le Fay.
Every incarnation.
That's true.
Boring. Morgan Le Fay is boring.
It's never a good character. Very cool if you're reading old King Arthur stories. Never cool if you're reading Marvel stories.
Maybe Morgan Le Meh. All right. The Gentleman, the Guy Ritchie movie that we all enjoyed to one degree or another.
Yep. Yeah, it's about great. Criminals and their pot empire in the UK and rival gangs and stuff and the usual Guy Ritchie craziness.
Yeah, had Matthew McConaughey as the American lead.
Hugh Laurie and Charlie Hunnam, right?
Hugh Laurie? Not Hugh Laurie.
It was Hugh Grant.
Hugh Grant.
And Charlie Hunnam?
Charlie Hunnam, yeah.
Yeah, and I believe Matthew McConaughey was looking to sort of abdicate the throne.
Yes.
And then there was sort of a power struggles, power vacuum stuff going on around it.
We don't know what the show's going to be about. We know that Theo James has been cast as the lead. I don't know who Theo James is.
I was looking him up.
Yeah.
Because I know...
You also don't know who he is.
Well, I know the name...
Right, we just heard
His name is Theo James.
but we presume it will at least loosely follow the plot, that it will be somehow involve sort of drug empire
or
stuff.
Or will it be a sequel? I don't know.
Yeah, like, in other words, are we going to see familiar characters? Is it going to be the same continuity or a rethink of it?
Yeah, I don't know.
So he was the lead in the TV series of Time Traveler's Wife. He was also in all the Divergents. He's also on White Lotus right now. He's actually really, really good.
Okay, I was going to say, mostly that sounds like bland white guy casting, but...
Yeah, but he's really good at what he does. Right, he's not boring at all.
Okay, cool. Yeah, no, I'm curious about this. I think, Nick, you and I have both forgotten this was happening.
Well, it also is, like, what? Vinnie Jones is joining, and so is, like, Giancarlo Esposito.
It's like Giancarlo Esposito.
And Peter Serafinowicz.
Oh, this is a good cast.
It's a great cast.
Speaking of good casts, they put the cast out for Star Wars The Acolyte, which is the one that takes place, I think, during the High Republic era.
It is. So, I think I read a thing that said it was near the end of the High Republic.
Yeah, it's at like the last days of the High Republic, which and sounds interesting.
High Republic is supposed to be a time of like relative peace and prosperity for the galaxy.
Yeah.
I know there's always like rising threats and things going on, so there is stuff.
But
it's
at
not
the
that
end of it,
stuff.
Who knows what it could be falling into chaos.
The Acolyte is a mystery thriller that will take viewers into a galaxy of shadowy secrets and emerging dark side powers in the final days of the High Republic era. A former Padawan reunites with their Jedi Master to investigate a series of crimes, but the forces they confront are more sinister than they ever anticipated.
Oh, that was a very dramatic reading, Randy.
That's just off the top of my head.
You know what that sounded like? That actually sounds like what Rings of Power is to Lord of the Rings.
It kind
of
is, yeah.
Which is to say the rising of bad guys. But
you think we'll be like, which one of these guys is Palpatine? Which one is Darth Plagueis the Wise?
The shadowy underworldy stuff sounds cool to me. What is it? A Master and Padawan reunited? Did you say?
Yes, yeah. It sounds like a former Padawan.
Okay,
reuniting with her Jedi Master.
Padawan. Now, does that just mean that it's a Jedi Master now who was trained by another Jedi Master? So it'll be two Jedi Masters.
Her former Master.
Okay,
so I think she's an ex Jedi.
Okay, that's what I was wondering. Is she a Jedi at all?
The lead in this is Leslie Headland, right? Or is that the director?
That's the director.
That's the director. I don't remember who Leslie Headland is.
She did something in Russian Doll.
Oh, okay. The lead is Amandla Stenberg, who I don't know, but who looks good.
And
Manny Jacinto is in this from The Good Place.
Daphne Keene is also who played X-23 in Logan.
Oh, cool. All right. Carrie-Anne Moss, you might remember from The Matrix.
Yep. She was Morpheus.
And Lee Jung-jae is in this, who was the lead in Squid Game.
Squid Game, yeah.
Yeah, that's a good cast.
Yeah, it's a good cast. There's a bunch of people. I don't know all these people. With people from Queen and Slim, Inventing Anna, Russian Doll.
It'll be interesting because I don't know, can I watch any Star Wars after Andor, or will I only be thinking about the grinding cruelty of the Empire?
But this is a different era. The grand cruelty
of
the Empire.
I know, but I can't help but think about it all the time.
Dave, this is a prelude to the grinding cruelty.
There was still grinding cruelty. There were regimes.
Actually. No, there's dark secrets.
That's all I can think of.
Dark
now.
Secrets.
Andor has taken over my brain.
but this also seems like a little bit different in the way of Star Wars. Yes, you're going to get Jedi and stuff, but
yeah.
the Russian doll element is definitely. She's a. I mean.
Yeah.
It's director of that.
Yeah. I am interested in this, even though the High Republic as an era doesn't interest me.
Yeah.
What I'm hoping is that this will bring it to life, and I think it probably will, actually.
I think it will, too. It may make me want to read the comics, but probably not.
Well, I will say that the second season of High Republic that is going right now, the second issue, I'm loving the series.
Really?
It's a lot of fun.
Okay, all right.
He used the L word.
I did.
He's lesbianing the series.
I also love Andor.
You love Andor and the High Republic.
It's true. I love all Star Wars.
What about the prequels?
I've come around on
Nick
most
presses
of it.
Play.
What about the holiday special?
I can't abide that. I can even say that Jar Jar is my friend.
Jar Jar is my friend. last thing.
I have a friend in Jar Jar. People don't know. I'm going to interrupt this for a second.
Yeah, go ahead.
If you haven't seen what we were just singing the little ditty of, look up the Jesus Is My Friend song.
It's very catchy. It's going to be in your head the rest of the day, and it's just go ahead and replace it with Jar Jar.
It is a sincere song. It wasn't like done as a spoof.
Nope.
It's doofy as hell, and yet so catchy.
Yeah.
When did it come out? In like the 90s, I think.
Oh, was it that late?
It might have been.
I thought it was a 70s thing.
I think it's 80s or 90s.
Okay.
We'll look into it later, but just look it up.
Yeah. Just replace it with Jar Jar.
Let's see. The song is by Sunseed.
Yes, I remember that.
And that does not look like a 90s video, Dave.
Okay, what do we got?
In the early 1980s, they released a music video for its song, Jesus Is a Friend of Mine.
Okay.
The viral video currently has over 3 million views.
Yeah, we are not the first people to notice it, it turns out.
Anyway, Jar Jar is a friend of mine.
Okay, yes. What else we got?
And finally, Netflix has the rights to Gears of War, which I've never played.
I was going to say, have either of you played it?
No.
I I played like the multiplayer where you're all joining forces to fight hordes of monsters,
repairing the gears of the. Of the war machine so that it can go to war, right?
Yes.
Sure, but yes. You're basically like a tag team of people who are like going through killing monsters in a world of like it's post-apocalyptic?
Future?
Yeah, future.
Okay.
And are you all like real armored up looking dudes?
Kind of, sort of. It kind of depends, I think.
You're a sniper, you're not?
I played like the multiplayer one where you're just fighting, you're like trying to secure an area and like fighting horde. Yeah, horde mode.
And what are you fighting? Other people or monsters?
Monsters.
Yeah. Monsters.
They're like, are they just like nuclear monsters?
No, I can't really remember, but alien I remember monsters? Like alien monsters or is what my brain says.
Like Doom.
Yeah, demon, alien, somewhere in there.
So it sounds like the story is great.
Here's the thing we don't know. We don't know a lot about it, but we know that Netflix has it, and good luck with that.
Yeah, well, we've certainly been surprised by Halo, although I believe Halo is, of course, known for having pretty good lore. Yep.
Netflix has Resident Evil, which, man.
Oh, no, yeah, I forgot. Netflix, man, it's... Ooh.
Netflix also has Sandman, though, and they just announced season 2.
That's true. So that is good. True. I was very happy to see that.
And they did the Castlevania cartoon, which was good, so they have done a good video game thing.
Right.
And also some bad ones, I think. And also some bad ones.
All right, we're going to take a break for a minute, and we're going to come back and talk about comics for the week. We are talking comics for the week of Wednesday, November 10th. Yep. And I think the first thing to talk about is...
It's kind of a big week.
It is a big week. I think the first thing to talk about is Fantastic Four number one, right? Or,
oh, yeah.
I mean, it's not like a long time since the end slot, but it's been a little while since we had a Fantastic Four number one.
Yep. Sure. And I will say that, like, I can't remember the last time that there was a Fantastic Four, maybe Mark Waid's run, that, like, I don't even know if that was a relaunch or just a run, but that, like, kind of took hold, that captured people's imagination.
Yeah.
Slots seemed to go over okay, solid. But not be a big thing. No idea if this one will, because it gets off on a weird foot, but I think, Nick, you and I think both liked it pretty well.
I did. And Randy was good.
Lukewarm to uninterested. Sold,
but because it's, without giving too much weight, it's a time loop story. I'm very picky on my time loop stories.
So I flipped through it yesterday, Randy. You know, before you left, I was flipping through it and I was like, I got really bad vibes because I was flipping through it and I was like, there is no Fantastic Four in this Fantastic Four number one. Which is to say, I didn't see any costumes. I didn't see any powers except for the Thing doing some stuff.
Yeah.
And I was just like, this barely looks like the Fantastic Four. It looks like it could be a random Thing comic. Now, jump ahead to a day later. I've read the story. It's by...
Brian North.
It's by Ryan North, who did
the Scroll
Dinosaur
thing.
Comics and Unbeatable Squirrel Girl, and recently did the Secret Invasion from last week.
Right, so he's got... They're clearly putting him in charge of more mainstream Marvel stuff.
Yeah.
The Secret Invasion thing is going to be a big miniseries. It's going to be their sort of conceptual tie-in or thematic tie-in to the Netflix series.
While we're talking
Disney
creator
Plus
teams,
series, not Netflix.
What's that?
Disney Plus series.
Disney Plus, yes.
The artist on this is Iban Coelho. Who has done a bunch of... I don't remember what else he's done.
I couldn't
Iron
think.
Man, maybe. But the art is really good.
You know what it reminded me of is... Mark Bagley, kind of.
I can see that. I think it's better than Bagley stuff.
Interesting. I think he's about, like, similar... I mean it as a compliment as far as storytelling.
But he is a good storyteller.
But his stories go... It definitely takes what Slott did, because it seems...
Does it?
Well, it seems like the FF are at odds... With each other.
I just assumed that was a in media res thing.
I think
thing
it happened at the end of Slott's run.
Okay. Well, one way or another, I don't know what's happening.
No.
And this is a story, so you know, I do think this is potentially a misstep conceptually, but that's because I like this story. I'm going to, like, let it slide for now and see how it goes. It is a Ben and Alicia honeymoon story. They kind of...
Well, I don't think they're on the honeymoon. I think they're just kind of traveling because
it's
something has happened.
Thing. I thought it was a honeymoon.
They're not on a honeymoon because they've been married for a while.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah,
this
I thought it was like some kind of like...
Because they got married
like,
at the beginning.
I know, I guess I thought it was some special like honeymoon.
Do they have a
thing.
Daughter or something? Because they says something. He has a name.
He absolutely does.
He does have a daughter and she is somehow with Johnny.
Okay.
Yeah, things there is that things clearly were a little complicated. I know Johnny's dated Alicia before.
Something big happened, and we don't see it to the last page. I'm curious where that's going to go.
Right, but so let's go and talk about what the story is, though, and why it won us over, Nick.
But yeah, it's basically Alicia and Ben on a road trip, and they come across a town that is a little odd.
It's a little odd, and they stay the night, and some strange things happen, and they start to figure out maybe what's going on. And along the way... Well, go ahead.
I think you nailed it on the head, though. It is very much like FF by way of Doctor Who.
It is. It's the kind of thing where, you know how an average Doctor Who story begins? Many times they don't know what's going on.
Right.
And you're going to have to kind of figure it out along with the characters, kind of have an adventure. There is some action and stuff. But it is... There's also some neat high-concept stuff, and I think some good dialogue and interesting things between, like, Ben and Alicia, but also the townsfolk, because without saying too much, Randy mentioned there's some time-loopy stuff in it.
Yeah.
There's, what is it, the 50s?
It's like that. It's something
47,
like that.
I think, is what it is.
Yeah. And, you know, imagine...
12th, 1947.
Imagine before the sort of modern age of heroes, the thing walking around in a small town, and how that well that would go over. And then they get into some of the interesting time loop stuff, and I think it goes to some interesting places.
I also, this is kind of me not reading a ton of FF over the years. I've read certainly runs of it, but I really appreciated having Alicia Masters at the forefront of an issue, where you get to know her a little bit more.
She's pretty front and center, and she's a major character in it.
Well, she also is kind of like, has a Sue Storm kind of take charge, I'm going to do it my way kind of thing.
Yep.
And I really appreciated that. She's a great character.
I agreed. She mentioned at some point traveling with Silver Surfer, and I was like, that wasn't her, though, in the miniseries where it was him with the companion style, kind of like...
No, that was a...
Okay.
Mike Allred's thing? That was something else.
That's what I was thinking. I thought that was an original character traveling with, but yeah, of course, she goes back. She was the person, I think, who convinced the Silver Surfer to not let Galactus destroy the world.
That's right.
And way back in FF, what, 50 or whatever it was. So thanks, Alicia, by the way. FYI, thanks for our lives.
I also thought that Ryan North had a good handle on Ben.
You know what struck me as interesting is, like, this seemed to me more serious and less jokey. Either there was humor in it, for sure, but it seemed to me less more serious than, say, his scroll thing. Or actually, I thought the writing was better in this. I just did.
Well, it's also possible he's got a more of an affinity for these characters.
It's true, or just that he's got different modes.
Yeah.
He's like, there was just a little bit more of that, I don't mean this really in that negative a way, but like that slightly Joss Whedon-y snarkiness was a little bit more going on in the scroll thing. And it's not like this was without humor. It just didn't have that particular brand of it. But yeah, like, I definitely didn't think I was going to be sort of won over on it, and now I'm definitely wanting to read a second issue, see what the big mystery is, and see what he's going to do next.
I thought it was a good first issue.
It may win me over a little bit as I read through a little bit more, but I it's interesting.
Well, yeah, it's certainly an odd choice, but not the complete screw up I thought it was going to be.
I think it's a nice change of pace from Slott. And I appreciate that.
For me, it was like 100 times better than Slott. If nothing else, it was a compelling story.
It doesn't seem as hidebound by... A lot of people, when they come to FF, they bring this respect of, like, I want to do the first family justice. Even Waite's run was so much of, like, this is Stan and Jack. This is their baby. And I think you got to be willing to do something different. At least it's that.
Oh, I like this. The last page is a Fantastic Four fan page. It's kind of a loadout.
He breaks down how he... envisions them and like his rules.
I like the four rules. The Fantastic Four are fun. The Fantastic Four are adventurers. The Fantastic Four can do anything, and the Fantastic Four are accessible. I think those are really good rules for the FF.
Yeah, I like seeing a good sort of writer's notes. You know, like their what would you even call it? I mean. It's not a script. It's not a script or anything like that. It's just his thoughts on the FF from the new writer. But it suggests someone who has some good ideas about them. And this suggests to me that if this is going to be the case, that this will be a more sci-fi oriented Fantastic Four, but not necessarily in that sense of like flying to the negative zone and beating up Annihilus. Okay. I don't know if it's going to go for any of the big action adventure stuff. At least this first one doesn't. Now, somebody does, you know, like, there's some, the thing has to punch some stuff before all is said and done.
He did punch some stuff.
But it's almost more like, no, I said the thing does have to punch some stuff. But it's almost more, a little bit more like Doctor Who in the sense of, like, the action is, there is action and adventure and chasey kind of things, but it's not like, sort of, being a little bit smarter than that is the kind of point. Anyway, let's see how it goes.
On the other side of the street, DC has the new Golden Age, Geoff Johns, with a bunch of different creators, different artists, reintroducing the Justice Society, but also a notable character from the Justice Society, Infinity Inc. side of things, as well as kind of jumping around in time,
As far as to the Legion future,
yeah, well, it's all tied through Fate.
Yes, Dr. Fate,
And sort of his incarnations throughout the time stream.
Quick question: yeah. Am I correct that basically the events of Doomsday Clock did some reshaping of things? Dr. Manhattan's changes were like undone or altered.
I believe that is true, yes,
and that's how the JSA got reset up. Cut ahead to like a year or two later, where Geoff Johns is now picking up that thread, and so now we're going to see the JSA stuff. Clearly with a lot of mysteries associated with them. Now, I had somewhat mixed thoughts on this one, but I did like how it's... I liked a lot of parts of it, including the way it begins with a kind of a... one of those kind of chummy meetings of the Justice League, where they're kind of sitting around... Justice Society. They're sitting around the table, and they're kind of like... who is it who asks? Is it the Atom?
I believe it is.
Is it Adam?
Yes, it is the Adam, because he's like the goof.
Right, but he's kind of like, hey, I'm going out with this girl again. He's like, hey, Dr. Fate, tell me, are we going to have some kids in the future or whatever? And Dr. Fate is like, I cannot answer that question and destroy space-time.
I see the many possibilities, and I...
And he's like, oh, come on. He's like, well, all right.
Yeah, he gets him to do it. And then he's kind of like answering it sort of like parlor tricks for some about relationship questions for some of the other characters. And then he says something like, I see darkness or whatever. You're like, suddenly it turns serious.
I think this is the thing with Johns. I think he knows how to write a scene. Sometimes his connective tissues don't always land as a whole, but
he's a little like the J.J. Abrams, that mystery box J.J.
Yeah,
Abrams.
Yeah, he does like that stuff, yeah.
And to me, that was a little overwhelming in this as it jumped around in times. But a lot of the times I was liking the scenes.
Yeah, the scenes, there are some really good ones in here.
Well, it reminded me, of course, Johns is the guy who got the JSA back on its feet with James Robinson, and I think maybe another writer even in that mix somewhere, but back in the 90s and 2000s. And so, and you know, just, I haven't watched Black Adam yet, but, you know, obviously those characters are kind of back in the spotlight for that. And so I've been wanting to see some JSA stuff lately. I got to see some JSA stuff in here.
I also liked the scene with Detective Chimp, and I don't know his name, but like the current modern day.
Something with a K, the kid's name. He's like a young Middle Eastern kid.
Yeah,
Khalid?
Khalid, yes.
Yeah. You know, I am not a particularly big Detective Chimp fan, but I liked that sequence. I thought it was good. Sometimes the way Johns does envision these characters, which is both a little bit more grounded and yet always still like in a very fantastical kind of setting, but they at the heart is they have to be like characters with normal sort of mortal motivations and desires and relationships. That stuff all intrigued me.
Yeah, I'll be curious to see where it goes. Justice Society comes out in a couple weeks, spinning off from there.
Then you have people
who's
like
writing that.
Johns.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you have artwork from, like, Steve Lieber, Todd Knox, Scott Collins, Victor Bogdanovich.
Oh, so this is a one-shot. So this is, like, I guess would it be fair to say that this one-shot is going to have, like, several mysteries and Justice Society and other books will fulfill them?
I think mostly it's going to be Justice Society. I don't really know.
I wasn't sure if there was, like, was there going to be, like, a Legion comic?
I don't think so.
This name, Brandon Peterson, that's not Mouse Guard guy, is it?
No, Brandon Peterson's, he was a cross-gen.
Oh,
he's an occasional customer. He's an Austin guy.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. He was a 90s artist guy. He does some really nice stuff.
Oh, very cool.
DC also had this week Wildcats number one. There's a lot of like stuff we haven't seen in a while.
Yeah, arguably a lot of 90s properties coming back, although the JSA is like always been a retro property. Well, I guess except in the 40s. Then it was a timely property.
We'll get to the
But not timely comics.
But so Wildcats number one, this is Matthew Rosenberg's new take on them. They're in the DC universe, but this is definitely, I mean, Green Arrow guest stars and a couple other people show
That's
up.
That's definitely
right.
A new take.
Maybe even more than soft reboot, a reboot of their place in the DCU.
Yeah, it's a sort of new take on Grifter. There's a Zealot.
You'll see Fairchild, Deathblow, a lot of characters from that Wildstorm setting.
Yeah. So, worth a look if you are a fan of the Wildcats. Also, the very 90s project.
I was going to say.
Death of Superman 30th Anniversary. There's a reprint of the Death of Superman issue, if you've never read it. It's actually not bad. It's one of those, isn't it like every panel, it's like full panel kind of thing?
I mean, I still think it's a good issue.
Randy was asking, is the original Death of Superman, was it every page was a splash page though?
Yeah, I think the final issue, because it was like slowly shrinking down, it was like a 9-panel grid, and then it was 7 panels, like I feel like every issue.
Oh, it was like a descending.
The action to get bigger and bigger, until in the end it was
that
just like.
That sounds right, actually.
I know that in the tribute issue, which also comes out this week, that has like a revisit from the creators, they definitely did that with the seeming return of Doomsday in it, the Doomsday-like thing that appears.
Yeah.
They cut started moving to splash pages.
But in addition to that reprint, this new Death of Superman, it's by a lot of the original creators. Dan Jurgens writes the main story. Jerry Ordway writes something.
Roger Stern.
You know what I noticed? I only have read the first story in there, which is, I guess Dan Jurgens kind of gets the lion's share. He was both writing and drawing it when that happened, right?
Yes.
And what I think that they did, which was kind of neat, is there's a sort of meta quality to it, because it's basically, it's Superman's son, you know, like when he was, you know,
little baby, yeah.
Like when he was like 10 or something like that, or 12. And he finds out at school, they're like, we're going to talk today about one of the big events of the 1990s or whatever, like the death of Superman. And he's like, he didn't know that his dad had died before.
Yeah.
I was like, that's actually kind of a clever idea that he finds out about it in school. He goes home and he's mad at Lois. He's mad
like,
at his
you
mom.
You never told me dad died.
Yeah, and she rightly says, she's like, I kind of hope to tell you when you were older.
Yeah.
And it's kind of one of those almost Astro City type things. It's like, it's such a bizarre conversation. But yes, it's a parent trying to figure out when to tell a kid something that's a little traumatic. And then the meta thing that I kind of liked in it was that when she tells him about it, you know, essentially, she is talking about how readers felt about it at the time. She's like, it was, you know, she's like, yes, we, you know, now we know he came back. She's like, but at the time, it was like the worst thing that had ever happened to me in my life, and it meant so much to see him fighting out there for our lives. And as she's talking about it, it's like, yes, that's how the people in the world felt, but that's kind of also how fans felt about the time. They really felt like they had witnessed something big. It was, you know, one of those events that had some impact.
Yeah.
And, yeah, if you were one of those dudes, I was, who stood in a line, like, to get it and stuff.
I was working at a shop, so I was the one.
You're on the other side.
I was maintaining that line.
Yeah.
I was standing in a line.
We need you on that wall. We want you on that wall.
I was standing in a line at Booksource.
I was in line at Funny Papers at the Dobie Mall. Neither of these places are in existence anymore.
I was behind the counter at Fusion Comics in Fort Collins, Colorado, also not in existence anymore, because the owner didn't pay his taxes.
Well, that will be a problem eventually.
Yes, it will. I think all these guys think it won't be, but it will be. I think that's what closed Thor's hammer in town, actually.
Oh, man.
It's fun. It's a bit of nostalgia.
Yeah.
And if you really want to go all in, there is the $20 version that comes in a black poly bag and has a black armband in it.
Yep, which we've already sold a few of, and once it's gone, it's gone. But this is your last chance to get a black armband and show that you were there to mourn Superman and that you are his true pal. And if you don't have one, by the way, you are absolutely his enemy.
this weekend, Wakanda Forever is coming. I'm sure we'll have our take on it next week on the podcast. But there is a new one-shot Black Panther Unconquered, which is a new one-shot from Brian Hill, who has written a bunch of Vertigo books and other stuff, that it's sort of a standalone Black Panther story.
But it's a new series, though?
No, I believe it's a one-shot.
Oh, okay.
I got that impression from reading it was a one-shot.
A lot of one-shots this week.
Yeah, there's a lot of one-shots this week. However, in terms of new miniseries, there is Spider-Man The Lost Hunt, which is J.M. DeMatteis, the original writer of wrote some of the Clone Saga stuff, also wrote the famous
Kraven's Last Hunt.
Yep, one of the most famous Spider-Man stories of the 90s.
This takes place in Portland when Peter is with Mary Jane and their daughter. No, they're about to have a daughter. And Peter has no powers. So Ben Reilly has taken over as Spider-Man, and he and Mary Jane are trying retirement out. And it's going to be a story that ties in Kraven and Peter and his non-powered, and it's described as sort of the flip side to the Ben Reilly Spider-Man miniseries that they just put out.
Okay. So we know that, like, Marvel has been kind of letting some of their classic creators, like Peter David and stuff like that, go back to some of their more notable eras. You know, Peter David went back and did some stuff about the symbiote Spider-Man suit, so that he's going back and doing some Grey Hulk stuff and things like that. And this is a chance to let J.M. DeMatteis, who, you know, he did one of the all-time great Spider-Man stories, kind of revisit the era.
Yeah, so this is this has the Grim Hunter, the son of Kraven, and Gregor, the guy who trained Kraven the Hunter.
Okay, so that's fair. Yeah. Gregor.
And like I say, a non-powered Spider-Man, and we're going to tie into all of that stuff. And it's also going to serve as the origin of Kraven the Hunter, which I don't think we've fully gotten before.
Yeah, I guess that's true. Even in that original Kraven's Last Hunt, which had some discussion of it, he kind of talked about it in vagaries.
And then there's Sabretooth and the Exiles, If you follow the X-Men stuff, you know that Sabretooth is one of the guys who he killed people and they buried him under the island. But now he is with other people who have been rejected by the island, and that is their team. That's why they're the Exiles. They are people who can't be on Krakoa.
Isn't that a little bit like Jack the Ripper as the head of your team?
A little bit. Well, the team includes Nanny, Orphan Maker, Toad, and some other people I've never heard of.
Of those, I would say Toad is the most heroic sounding.
So is this actual Sabretooth, or is this Sabretooth from, like, another
parallel? We were trying to figure that out yesterday.
I think it's actual Sabretooth.
Because last I remember Sabretooth, he was, like, down in the pit.
Yeah, I think they got him back out of the pit. Oh, no. His freedom was short-lived. He was captured by the anti-mutant organization Orcus.
Oh, okay.
So the Exiles are on a mission to stop Sabretooth before he kills again, but I believe ultimately he's going to wind up being the head of this team, or okay. At least that's the way the title has led me to
believe. That's sort of a fun way to have it happen, which is like, let's bring this guy in. He's our leader now. But getting from that point A to point B sounds kind of fun.
It's also worth noting this issue, by the way, this week, there's some really good second issue of Spider-Man, which gets more into the Spider-Verse, Spider-Wasp stuff. New issue of Superman, Son of Kal-El, which is really, really good.
Has
Cal talking to John for really the first time since he's got back, and there's some notable stuff.
Some big father-son stuff.
Yeah, some big father-son stuff.
I randomly read an issue of Moon Knight this week, since I had liked the Moon Knight annual last week, and I was like, let's see what happens if you walk in on issue 17 of Moon Knight. And as it turns out, I found it quite approachable.
It's a good book.
The recap caught me up. I liked Jed McKay's writing on it, and might have to go back and read some trades now.
And there's also some indie stuff, some Image stuff. Dark Ride number 2 comes out. I think we all really like Dark Ride.
That's a lot of fun.
I need to read the second issue on that. How would you? What's the quick log line for that book?
It's a Disney but horror. Basically, it's a horror.
Yeah,
it's
Disney theme park
based around horror, and there's clearly some kind of like devil behind it.
Yep. A little tongue-in-cheek.
Image has a new book called Gospel, which is kind of a Miyazaki take on 16th century England.
Yeah, it's like it's set in, you know, kind of a historical medieval era. I think the reign of Henry VIII, maybe.
Yep. But there's some magic and stuff.
It's
very pretty. It has really nice artwork.
Yep.
There is the one-shot The Knight and the Lady of Play by Jonathan Luna.
I liked that one.
I really liked this. I thought it was a good sort of standalone kind of
horror
story.
You know, I really liked Jonathan Luna's... Eternal Empire?
Yeah.
Has that two-volume fantasy series. And clearly I like that dude when he's in fantasy mode. I've liked his other stuff, too, including sci-fi future-y stuff. But it's just interesting that's... Seems to be a mode he's been in lately. As you noted, Randy, it's tough to pull off a good one-shot, so that was an interesting one-shot. I somewhat likened it in my head to the Green Knight, so anybody who liked that A24 Green Knight movie might consider it.
Then there's Two Graves, number one, an Image book that is basically about a woman maybe traveling with death. It's got a little bit of that fancy, what do you call it, urban fiction, not...
Oh, urban fantasy? Yeah.
Yeah, something like that. Kind of like modern-day fantasy kind of thing. There's also the very unusual, from Ablaze Comics, Traveling to Mars, written by Mark Russell, who does a lot of political stuff. And this is basically the story of a guy who is sort of a divorced nobody who used to manage a pet store in Alabama, and how he becomes the first man on Mars in 2048.
Okay.
It is a really fun take. It is basically a character study. I don't know where the story's going to go, but as a first-issue character study, it was really interesting.
People on Mars, I would assume, could potentially, like, spoof the, you know, the billionaire space race stuff going on now.
Well, but there's, like, he's going to be the only one there.
Okay.
Yeah, it is.
So there's maybe a different angle on it.
Yeah, it's interesting. We got the first trade paperback of Scotty Young's Twig.
Yep, that's his very beautifully illustrated, not by him, but somebody else.
By Kyle Strom.
Kyle Strom. Fantasy series. I'm not quite sure what to compare this one to, other than it has like a sort of a Pixar Miyazaki.
Well, they compare it to Bone, Dark Crystal, and Labyrinth.
Okay,
which
sure.
I would say is all reasonable.
Yeah, sure.
There's also the second volume of Gideon Falls, the Jeff Lemire, Andrea Sorrentino horror book.
Yeah,
which I haven't read. I'm looking forward to reading the finale of it.
I never have read the finale to it either, but yeah, it had elements. It had actually a surprising variety of elements, but yeah, it's hard sort of suspense and horror.
And then there is the Night Eaters hardcover, which is from the creators of Monstrous.
What is it called?
The Night Eaters?
Eaters?
Yep.
Okay.
I don't know much about it. I just know it's the creators of Monstrous, a really pretty looking book.
Yeah.
And the Mark Waid Flash Omnibus, if you're looking for some of the best Flash ever done. This is early Mark Waid, right after he transitioned from being an assistant editor to a writer.
Hmm.
It's got Mike Paraback artwork on a lot of it.
Oh, man.
It is really, really good.
The famously lost too young Mike Paraback.
Yeah, really good stuff. I would highly recommend it. All right, let's take a break, and then we're going to come back and talk about some movies, and I think possibly TV. Okay, let's start off with the new Netflix movie, Enola Holmes 2, which I'll say there's going to be spoilers.
Yeah.
So if you haven't watched it, you want to skip ahead a little bit. Nick and I both watched this. Dave, did you watch the first one?
Nope.
It was good.
Even though there is a certain timelessness to certain properties, and I'm going to say it's like Robin Hood, King Arthur, Sherlock Holmes, the big classic adventure properties.
Yep.
For whatever reason, Sherlock Holmes, like, I feel like I've kind of gotten in my fill for a little while. But I know this is supposed to be quite good, and I may loop back around and check it out at some point.
That is generally how I feel about King Arthur, unless Guy Ritchie is going to do a sequel.
Wrong. Well, awful.
The movie's so bad it made Nick not press play.
Yeah, my King Arthur press play is I waver. I'm not automatically pressing play anymore.
No. What was that with Robin Hood? And Robin Hood's another one that, like, what was the modern Robin Hood?
Oh,
where
they, oh, that was the
Otto something, is that his name, or director?
No, the director. Well, Ridley Scott did Ridley Scott.
One, but there was like also a, there's like been another.
Is there one?
Was it Ridley?
There was.
What was the one where they were acting like they were Delta Force and they had their bows out in front of them and all that? Was that the Ridley Scott one?
No, I don't think so.
Ridley Scott was very melodramatic.
Ridley Scott was kind of like quasi-historical,
and it had Russell Crowe and
This wasn't this. This was the one that I was forced to watch. Was maybe the 2010? Yes, I think it was. No, 2010 is that one. This was the 2018 Robin Hood.
Oh, is this the one with Jamie Foxx?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Yes. No, that's bad.
I gotta know who did it because.
By the way, I will say this though, Randy. Describing it as them moving like special ops guys with their bows out in front like that. That almost sounds cool.
You think it does.
It almost sounds cool.
It is not
It sounds
cool.
like Hot Shots parody.
It does. It sounds like... Otto Bathurst directed it. It's got Taron Egerton as Robin Hood, Jamie Foxx is, and then Ben Mendelsohn's like the bad guy. Man, it is one of the worst things I've ever seen. And I like archers and stuff.
I will tell you, I do think that Robin Hood is also in a bit of a slump as a property. But... let's take it back to Sherlock Holmes.
But what if you had space arrows?
Quick remind me, the Enola Holmes?
So Enola Holmes is a series of books written...
YA.
YA books about...
Yah.
Yah. Holmes. Right, it's pronounced Yah.
Yah.
Yah books. It is...
We're sorry, we're a little giddy today.
There's a gas leak in the office. Enola Holmes is Sherlock Holmes' younger sister.
Yes.
Okay.
And
his ward, essentially.
But he doesn't really want any part. He wants to put her in a school and be done with her. At least that's where he was.
That's where he was.
Her mom is a sort of eccentric, bomb-throwing...
Anarchist?
Suffragette.
Yes.
Okay.
Played by Helena Bonham Carter. And she's delightful.
Oh, that's fun.
And she sort of disappeared. The first one was about her disappearing. And she does sort of, like, leave Enola on her own. That's definitely presented as she's a good mom to her, but maybe not the best mom. Like, she's a little bit too independent to be a mom.
Yeah. And she trained her well, though.
Yeah. So Enola Holmes is played by...
Millie Bobby Brown.
You may know her as Eleven on Stranger Things.
I'm going to make a proclamation, though.
Yep.
I think the sequel is better than the first one.
I agree. I think they did a lot of the setup work in the first one. So this one, they had all the characters in place, including her, like, her on-again, off-again royal lover.
Yep.
You're
saying it's the Empire Strikes Back of Sherlock Holmes girl yaw movies?
Sure, why not? Let's say that.
Yes. Let's roll with that.
Yes, that's what it is.
Yaw movie.
It's the Empire Strikes Back of Sherlock Holmes girl yaw movies. Yes.
Sorry, I told you we were a little giddy today. Okay.
So, she has started her own detective agency.
Not going well.
Against the wish of her brother. Nobody really wants to hire a young girl.
Because everyone thinks it's Sherlock.
Everything's Sherlock. They go to Holmes and they're like, wait, you're not Sherlock Holmes.
You're a girl.
And also, this is early in Sherlock Holmes' career. Played by Henry Cavill, by the way.
Yeah, he's great.
He's great in this. But she winds up being hired by this young girl who's Foster's. She's not her sister. She's like... They found family.
Yeah, found family.
Her sister's disappeared. They are match girls. They work in this match factory.
Yep.
And this girl has disappeared. And it leads Enola into this place of, like, high society and conspiracy and workers' revolution elements.
Corrupt cops.
Was it Commissioner Grail? I think.
Yes, played by David Thewlis.
David Thewlis, who's great. I don't want to give too much away about it, but there's also Moriarty is introduced in this, a very new take on Moriarty, which I really liked. And there's a post-credit sequence that introduces another familiar face from the Sherlock Holmes meet, which I really liked.
And the character or the actor who plays him is great.
Yeah. So this is really fun. A lot of the fun is watching Bobby Brown be like a she talks to the camera, by the way.
Yeah, she breaks the fourth wall.
I learned that the other day when I read an article where she was saying that when Stranger Things starts up again, she's deathly afraid that she's going to keep looking at the camera, which you're not supposed to do.
Yeah, you're not supposed to do, yeah. Yeah, and she does, she occasionally does that Jim from the Office thing where like, she'll look at us and like, is the thing that's happening.
Fun. I love that this has the energy of Guy Ritchie's Sherlock Holmes.
It does feel
and it kind of runs rampant a little bit that, because she is so animated in this.
And just, you were talking about earlier, I was hearing y'all talk about this, and you were saying that, you know, obviously, she broke out on Stranger Things. Everybody likes her on Stranger Things, but her character is this very much Stranger in a Strange Land kind of character in there.
She's and a little one note.
Here she gets to like stretch her legs and do more, just a lot more acting stuff.
Well, and she also gets to have fun, and where Stranger Things is so dour,
a little bit weepy and angsty.
Very angsty. Yeah. This one, she gets to have fun and make jokes to the camera. She gets to kick the shit out of people, which is a lot of fun. And I just think there's a high level of energy and entertainment with this.
Nick, when I get around to it, am I going to like it or am I going to not like it?
Did you like the Guy Ritchie ones?
Yeah, I did.
Then I think you'd actually like them.
I liked the first Guy Ritchie one. Everybody knows the second one wasn't as good, but it was still all right.
Yeah, it wasn't as good, but it had its moments.
And this one is different. This is actually better.
And then Moriarty was also really good. Who played Moriarty?
It was Jared Harris.
It was Jared Harris. He was a great Moriarty.
Yes.
So,
but this Moriarty is a really good twist.
Yeah, it is. I liked it.
I don't know if I'll ever get around to reading the books, but I really like. Yeah. I love this character. And
we have
glad
the graphic novels on the shelf.
Yeah.
Yep, just wait until you're in the mood for some ya-fiction.
Ya-fiction! Dave, jumping back in time a little bit, just like Dr. Fate in Golden Age.
Yes.
You watched The World's Most Dangerous Game.
Yes, this is a movie that basically invented a genre which has perpetuated since forever. It's based on a book, I think, or maybe a short story. Randy, do you mind looking it up and seeing what year it came out? Because I want to say it was like the 20s or the 30s. This is an old movie. This is a movie from the ancient world. A demon of the ancient world.
Ye old movie.
I was there, Gandalf, 3,000 years ago.
Well, there was a Roku channel had a series about in 2021.
1932.
Is that what you're looking for?
That is not what I'm looking for. Thank you, Nick. 1932 is what I was looking for.
Sorry, it wasn't coming up. That's what's coming up instead.
Joel McRae and Fay Wray?
Yeah, Fay Wray, who played the original lady in King Kong, who King Kong kidnapped.
Who directed this?
I can't
remember. Ernest B. Shodsack?
Yeah, not somebody I know, but Joel McRae is... I have seen him in another movie, one of those good Frank Capra movies.
He actually directed the original King Kong.
Oh, okay.
Or no, yeah, he co-directed.
Okay. I was going to say, I think the guy who did the music, Max Steiner, did the music for King Kong. But beyond all this behind-the-scenes shenanigans, though, World's Most Dangerous Game, everybody kind of, I think, knows this. It's about a guy who, like, hunts people. You've seen versions of it from, I'm going to say, from Hard Target to, what was that one where there was, like, the Blumhouse thing where, like, supposedly
The Hunt...
And Predator is hugely influenced by this. The way they build the traps to get the Predator at the end, basically you see the guy doing the same stuff in this. But there was all these details I didn't know about this story, and it's one of those old movies, like when I saw Island of Lost Souls, which is basically that's the Island of Dr. Moreau,
yep.
Or any of these, any of the sort of the big old movies that a lot of the artists, comic artists of like the 60s and stuff would have grown up with. You can see the origins of, like, all the supervillains. They all had their origins in these movies. Like, Dr. Moreau in Island of Lost Souls, like, that is, like, Dr. Doom, right? And in here, you have, like, a guy who's, like, kind of Kraven, right? He's a Russian hunter. Nick, the premise of this, which I didn't know, that he's a Russian exile who was a count or something like that. He's Count something or another.
Count Zaroff.
Very, you know, he is the, genteel villain. He is the, sit down for drinks with me kind of villain. But yes, he was like, he escaped the Russian Revolution. He's got this island. It has reefs around it. And he changes up the lights in the nearby channel so that, the shipping lanes, so ships run aground on there. He picks up the survivors and then hunts them for sport. but he doesn't, tell them what they are in for. They think they're just guests, and they're like, oh, he went off on some hunting expedition with a few of them to hunt stuff on the island earlier today. Oh, they haven't come back. I don't know what's going on. And he keeps them thinking that he's getting, a boat repaired to take them to the mainland. Our guy, who's the hero in it, is himself a hunter of big game. Like, he's hunted tigers and all this stuff and written a book on it. So when he shows up, the count is like, ah, finally someone who understands the true heart of the hunter. And, but, like, when he arrives, there's a woman there and her kind of drunken brother from another shipwreck. And while the count is, like, playing the piano because he's so genteel that way, she's like, I think he's up to something. She clearly has already picked up on it. That's Fay Wray. And she kind of knows what's up and starts trying to explain it to him. And so eventually they investigate. By the way, he has a trophy room. He explains that he shows Randy before he takes people on the hunt. He literally has heads and stuff mounted
like
in there.
Like people's heads?
People's heads.
So how did they not see this?
He only shows them when they are about to be hunted.
Okay, it's it feels like otherwise that might give things away a little
bit. He doesn't just casually show it.
He's like, there's my trophy room full of human heads. Don't worry about it.
Remember how I said the brother was a drunken lout?
Yes.
He takes that guy because he's annoying him that evening. He's like, you know what? He's like, would you like to come down and see my trophy room? And he's like, oh, good. You're going to let me in on the big secret. And everybody else goes to bed. And then, he doesn't show up, and she freaks out, and she goes and gets the new guy, and they go and looking for him, and they find his body in the trophy room, and they get caught by the count, and eventually he releases them on the island for his hunt. But he does say that usually he's, kind of got a procedure he follows, but that guy was being such a lout, he had to, go and hunt him that night.
I guess the drunken brother in this played the lead in King Kong. He played Carl Denham.
Oh, that's wild. I didn't realize that. So this is even more than I thought. It's like the King Kong team reunited.
Yeah, it is.
Well, I will say, I've been describing the plot and stuff. It is a very fun movie. It is a brisk movie. It's like only like an hour and 15, 20 minutes or something like that.
Yeah, 63 minutes. That's
63 minutes, barely over an hour, yeah. So you get in and get out fast. You can see everything. The hunt is actually cool. He both hunts with a bow and then later a rifle. They set up traps for him, but he's too smart for a lot of the traps. There's some good twists and turns. And again, you will, watching this, you'll be like, oh, here is half of Predator. They decided to do an alien version of World's Most Dangerous Game, and that's how Predator happened. I had a really good time watching it.
Dave, where did you watch this? Where is it streaming?
I think it was HBO.
I was going to say, HBO has the largest collection of... Because they have AMC classics. Yeah.
I thought they had... Who had Criterion? Who got Criterion? Was that not...
It is Criterion.
Yeah, okay. So that might be, yeah.
I was... I had actually been kind of in the mood for some old... some old school horror movies, like Universal Monsters or other stuff like that. And had I just saw this one and I was like, oh, it's real short. Let's just watch that while I'm having dinner or whatever. And it ended up being great.
Cool.
That's awesome. I might give it a shot, because that sounds kind
of
fun.
It's a lot of fun. By the way, you'll notice when the guy shows up shipwrecked at first, Nick, he has the total Doc Savage look.
Oh,
which
very
is to
cool.
say, he's not like bulging with muscles, but he's fit.
Yeah.
And he's got like this torn shirt where it's torn in just the right way to show off his muscles.
That's how I tear all my shirts.
Absolutely, absolutely. You have to if you want to look like the Man of Bronze.
I want to flex my biceps.
You want to be the Man of Bronze.
I want to be the Man of Bronze. I'm 10, really, but... So, on the flip side of things, I watched the Roku original Weird.
Oh, right. You and apparently every single other person on my friend's list.
And told people who couldn't access Roku to just to steal it.
I wasn't 100% sure that was actual Weird Al.
He very deliberately told them not to steal it.
I know, I'm kidding.
He told them that there was a very possibly no way, VPN, to watch it if you were in Australia. He said, you probably have a torrent of questions, but that's all I can answer.
Yeah.
Yes, I believe Weird Al is kind of like, well, you know, they can't watch it anyway. You're not losing anything.
Right.
Anyway, this is directed by Eric Appel. It's his first thing. He is a Funny or Die guy. This is made by Funny or Die Films. It does feel like a Funny or Die trailer made into a movie.
It makes sense.
It is delightfully fun. So
it's a spoof of, like, rock biopics.
It is a spoof of biopics. For those who don't know, Weird Al famously had a VH1 Behind the Music, and it was like the most wholesome Behind the Music ever. Where it was like, he's like, yeah, I kind of wish that I had, you know, had the drugs
never,
for groupies.
He had never been
done
the,
anything.
Yeah, they've been like the super party animal, never become addicted to drugs, never any of that stuff.
So
it was 45 minutes of him talking about his accordion.
Yes. So this, instead, Diedrich Bader does the grizzled narrator version of Al from the future. It opens with him coming in from a car accident, nearly dead in a. In a hospital, and they like jolt him back to jump. They call a time of death, and then he wakes up and he's like, "Somebody hit me a #2 pencil and a paper." and he's like, and it does the 70s Goodfellas style. Maybe I should start at the beginning, and then it rewinds back, and it is him, a young version of him. His father, played by Toby Huss, who's a comedian you would definitely know. His mom, played by Julianne Nicholson, who looked familiar. They are his parents. His dad works at the mysterious factory. He's like, what do they make at the factory? He's like, you'll find out when you go to work at the factory. His dad has lost a hand to the factory. And Al just wants to play accordion and make up lyrics to songs that already exist. Which his father says is of the devil. A chance meeting with... first of all, he has his three roommates, played by his actual bandmates, I think. They're like talking about how they're all in their 20s now and they should do what they want. And he tells them, I always wanted to make up lyrics of songs. I'm like, you should do that. And while making a bologna sandwich, he's inspired to sing My Bologna with his forbidden accordion.
I mean, this has a pretty substantial cast.
And then he has a chance to meet with Dr. Demento, played by Rainn Wilson.
By the way, I don't know if these days people know who Dr. Demento was, but he was like the, was this like the 60s?
Yeah. Yeah,
he was the original novelty song guy.
Yeah.
Well, actually, there's always been people like that, but he was the breakout.
So Dr. Demento is like the big, in this role, the big movie producer who, like, he's like, you're going to go far, kid.
Yeah.
And then, Al becomes like a sensation. But...
Randy, you told me about the...
Yes, I'm going to mention this part. So he is somewhat distressed. He's like, oh, people only know me as a parody guy. He is the top of the charts... The world's most famous musical artist right now. People want to parody his songs so they can get the Yankovic bump. And he's like, I don't want to do this anymore. I'm going to make original songs. So, fueled by LSD, given to him by Dr. Demento, by accident, or on purpose, but not deliberately for him, he comes up with his own original song, Eat It, which he then gets the record executives to play, and he finally gets a record deal.
Uh-huh.
And later on, he will bemoan that Michael Jackson made a song called Beat It, that's a parody of his song Eat It. And now everyone's going to think that Michael Jackson created the song. And then also Madonna, played by Evan Rachel Wood, she wants the Yankovic bump. So she seduces him, and they become the dangerous power couple. She introduces him to drinking and because she wants him to parody her song.
How is Daniel Radcliffe in this?
Daniel Radcliffe's amazing in this, surprisingly ripped. Also, I want to provide one last little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Pablo Escobar wants Al to come perform at his birthday party. Sure. Pablo Escobar, the drug kingpin.
Sure. Yes.
That will eventually tie into Madonna and Al and the weirdest shit ending for this one. And you want to stick around for the ending. There is a new song, And there's two post-credit sequences.
Oh, nice.
And this was a delight. Like, the trailer looked like fun, and the actual movie is super funny. Especially if you know Weird Al stuff at all, but even if you don't, it's a dead-on parody of, like, you know, the music biopics.
All those behind-the-music things, yeah, and biopics.
Yeah.
It sounded like a lot of fun. I'm what you call a casual Weird Al fan. I've never owned any of the albums. I watch the music videos, I'm amused by them, and then I move on.
I think that's as far as you need to go.
But it sounded, everything you told me, I'm like, yeah, I know who Dr. Demento is, I know who Madonna is, and so it all sounded like fun stuff.
Let me give one last bit here.
Yeah.
When he goes to Dr. Demento's place for a big, you know, 60s-style music party, as well as everybody's there, Dimitri Martin plays Tiny Tim, Paul F. Tompkins plays Gallagher, Akiva Schaffer plays Alice Cooper, Conan O'Brien plays Andy Warhol, Emo Phyllis plays Salvador Dali, Jack Black plays Wolfman Jack and is amazing in it, David Dalsmalchian, who you may know as the guy from the Baba Yaga guy from Batman, plays a guy named John Deacon, who is from Queen. There is, like, all those people are at this thing as these like famous people. There's a guy playing Pee Wee Herman. It is basically the 80s equivalent of like a power party.
Yeah.
And it's hilarious. Like, you keep spotting all these people.
That is a crazy lineup.
Yeah. Yeah. This is really funny and really, really worth a look. And just a
I think most of my friends who were watching it all seem to be having a good time.
It's definitely.
Now, they were all a bunch of Weird Al freaks like you are.
Yep.
So I don't know if I can trust them.
Fair.
But I do think I'll try and check it out at some point.
Then to change topics completely, Nick, tell us about The Lighthouse.
Yeah, you want to talk about something that's not fun at all. No, I'm kidding.
You know,
I'm kidding.
It was kind of fun in its way.
So yeah, this is what you, how long ago did this come out?
Just like a couple years ago.
3 years ago?
Yeah, 2-3 years. I think it was right before the pandemic. So yeah, talking about like 3 years.
Before or after Witch? It's
definitely after.
Definitely after The Witch. Yeah. So this is Robert Eggers' second film?
Yes, and then
maybe
he did
after
the,
like
then
a short
the
film
Northman.
Or something.
Yeah, that was but
Robert Eggers is an interesting
he's a
fellow.
Big super weirdo.
He so apparently this is
by the way, Nick, I think you probably noticed this immediately. It is filmed in a weird aspect ratio.
Yeah, it's definitely
like when we saw it on the screen, it felt cramped at first because it's like a square like TV.
Yeah, it's in that aspect ratio.
And yet I think that was probably a very intentional. I know it's a very intentional.
Oh, it's very intentional.
Because it's a claustrophobic movie.
So the story frames on two people who are coming in to relieve a lighthouse team.
Yep.
On an island.
Yep.
And they are played by Robert Pattinson, and
he's the young guy, and Willem Dafoe is the
grizzled old.
He's the veteran of the
veteran,
lighthouse.
Yes. And there's a little bit of a power play by Willem Dafoe.
Yep.
He is definitely sort of like lording over Robert Pattinson, who's definitely experiencing that, getting annoyed by doing all the droll
drudge work kind of stuff.
He then finds like a weird mermaid scrimshaw.
Yep. There's also a weird mystery of like only what do you call it? Like what's his name? Willem Dafoe will change out the light bulbs in the like the or whatever.
But
in the
only
top.
He can go.
Only he gets to go up to the top of the lighthouse. It is not allowed.
And he goes naked, I believe.
That sounds right. This is a movie that is very easily steeped in symbolism.
Yes.
You know, light at its most basic represents like truth in a lot of things. And so,
well, there's also Prometheus and
there's like, Prometheus stealing fire and all this stuff. I have read an interpretation in which the pair of them are Prometheus and some other god.
It's his son, right? Or
I don't
Poseidon?
Remember. Maybe. By the way, that reminded me, the bit where Willem Dafoe goes on that angry rant, wild rant, is one of the most insane things I've seen in my life.
Willem Dafoe channels crazy like no other.
Yeah.
I mean, he literally...
And he's given a great script to work with here. There's a certain repetitiveness
them...
as you see them moving up and down in this very kind of cramped space, eating together multiple times.
Robert Pattinson having fights with seagulls.
Yes.
Specifically, and by the way, one-eyed seagull.
This is all filmed in really beautiful black and white.
Yes.
Like, there's some amazing photography in here. Some of the best photography I've ever seen in a movie.
I think I think I had some trepidation just because I was like, it doesn't really. I don't know. it didn't really jive with me. The story, I was like, eh, it's a character piece. Some people described it as horror. Some people described it as suspense.
I would definitely say it's not horror, but it's like an uneasy kind of suspense. And there are supernatural elements in it, or at least things you can interpret as supernatural. Right. But because it has dreamlike elements, a lot of times the movie is very open to interpretation.
And I also, after watching it, I looked up a couple things. Apparently, Eggers... this is an unfinished Edgar Allan Poe story.
I didn't know about that.
Yeah, and that he and his brother sort of finished it out a little bit, and this is their interpretation of it.
Interesting.
It was, and I kind of got that sort of gothic vibe to it.
Oh, yeah.
But this for me was a character study of two people at odds with one another, slowly descending into madness when their relief doesn't show up and storms are basically trapping them on an island together. Yeah. And with no food, because the storm
also
spoils.
By the way, some I never really sat down and tried to really parse it out, but I'm like, there is definitely some homoerotic undercurrents.
Oh, very much so.
And yet these guys are like about to kill each other too.
Yeah.
But it's like, oh, is that why the sudden he feels the call to violence? By the way, I thought Robert Pattinson also did a great job.
Yeah, Pattinson is one of those guys that I think got the raw deal from Twilight. He is an actor. I mean,
well,
he
this is
commits.
Like I mean, this is the kind of movie that I don't know if he did, but like at the very least, I would say probably deserves a nomination for like an Academy Award.
I think he got a nomination, if I remember correctly.
I think neither of us actually liked The Witch.
I loved The Witch.
Oh no, you loved The Witch. Who is it I've talked to?
I didn't like.
You didn't like The Witch as well.
And I haven't seen Lighthouse partly because of that.
By the way, I will say The Witch was beautifully filmed, and I liked big parts of it, but I found it unsatisfying at the ending.
Well, this one also has a slightly unsatisfying ending in a sense that it just kind of...
It's ambiguous.
Something happens,
and stuff.
Yeah. Something else happens, and you're left with the scene just looking... I mean, it's spoilers, it's a couple years old. Robert Pattinson being disemboweled by seagulls on the cliffs and the lighthouse disappeared.
Yep.
It's weird, very meta. It is not unlike The Witch, where...
Now, The Witch had a pretty specific ending.
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah.
However, I think I liked The Witch more. I think its commitment to sort of that era, the language, they both commit.
Well, I mean, there's the same commitment to language in this one, too. I would definitely say I liked Lighthouse better, but I'm going to revisit The Witch at some point. Robert Eggers, I think he's going to be one of these people to me a little like Aronofsky is, which is to say I'm actually not a big Aronofsky fan.
No.
His favorite movie for me is like his first movie, Pi.
Yeah.
And he kind of has a certain style of like downward spiral movies with characters. I feel he's a little one note. But, like, the actual scenes in it and the acting in his movies can be amazing, just really fantastic. And so it's pretty easy for me to watch any given one of a movie by Aronofsky. And I think I'd say the same of Eggers. These are all actually very watchable movies. I don't know if I'm ever going to be like, I loved that. I do want to watch The Northman and see where that stands in the pantheon, because it sounds like it's quite different from either of the previous two when I hear people talk about it. But I think he's a guy who's always going to intrigue me, and I don't know if he's ever going to be a favorite.
Right.
All right. Well, that'll wrap it up for us this time. We'll be back next time with more, and until that time,
yo, Joe.
Roguecast is a weekly podcast broadcast from Rogues Gallery Comics and Games in Round Rock, Texas. You can find us online on Facebook and at www.roguesgallerytx.com, and email us comments or questions at roguesgallerytx@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.